I'd like now to welcome back to the program Jack Leffler. He is a bioregional oral historian, a radio producer, writer, sound collage artist, former musician, and his new book is called Thinking Like a Watershed, Voices from the West. He will be speaking at Collected Works Bookstore on Friday the 19th of October at 6 in the evening, and then Sunday the 21st of October at 3 o'clock at Bookworks in Albuquerque. Welcome.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's great to be with you.
It's great to be with you, too. Now, thinking like a watershed, we are in a long-predicted, real crisis of water in the West. What is going on?
Well, there are myriad factors, not the least of which is brought about by climate instability. Which is in turn brought about by our presence and our over-vigorous presence on the planet. But the Southwest itself is a long, long history of being one of the most arid regions. Well, it is the most arid region on the North American continent. What I think of as the North American Southwest is my good buddy and yours, Bill DeBuis. And that excludes the presence of the geophysical boundary between us and North in Mexico. But the upshot is that there's a long history of peaks and dips in the amount of moisture that comes to us from the skies. And those peaks and dips determine how much water is actually going to be traveling down the existing watersheds. For example, the smaller watershed that we live in is the Santa Fe River watershed, but that's a part of the greater watershed of the northern Rio Grande, and which itself is sort of a lifeline that extends between southern Colorado all the way down to the Gulf of Mexico. And it bisects, as an oasis, it bisects New Mexico itself. And water comes and water goes. And right now we're in a point of growing drought, as I understand it. And that's something we really have to contend with. And I think that we have to contend with it on a basis of not just politics and science, but also on the wisdom wrought over the ages by people who are indigenous to this area.
Well, that's one of the things that I think is so strong and so interesting about this book, is that a response to a situation, a response to a crisis, sometimes requires a change in a person's or a community's state of mind. And when you talk about this whole term, thinking like a watershed, it's like putting yourself in a new and different state of mind than what you might be used to.
That's true. I have to say that I took the title of one of my favorite thinkers, Aldo Leopold, wrote an essay that's included in San County Almanac entitled Thinking Like a Mountain. And a few years ago, I had the opportunity to produce a one-hour radio special entitled Aldo Leopold in the Southwest, and thus really got deeply into his thinking, and also as expressed by two of his kids, Estella and Nina. And one of the things that came through loud and clear was, having come to New Mexico in 1909 with a degree in forestry from Yale, Aldo Leopold found himself in a totally different habitat than that which he was accustomed to be in. And much of his thinking about ecology evolved right here in the American Southwest, the arid Southwest. And as a result of this thinking, he did an incredible amount toward achieving a whole new perspective with regard to humanity relative to homeland habitat. Well, I took the title Thinking Like a Mountain and thought, you know, that's almost too inert for where we are right now, and thought Thinking Like a Watershed is a lot closer to the mark. And then I got to thinking, how does one think like a watershed? And I realized that there is an entire array of factors, not only with regard to what a watershed really is, which is that cradle that funnels water down a given shed as far as it'll go, and its relationship to other watersheds adjacent to it. It's also imagining all of those factors, the wildlife, the flora, the fauna, all of it, us, the human species, everything, the water itself, the four seasons, all being in motion, all at the same time, which takes a powerful point of view. But it's something that can be, I think, brought to the very foremost of somebody's mind. And so that's what we did here in this book, and what seemed to me to be the best way to approach this, especially here in the Southwest, was to create an anthology that would involve the voices of people from different indigenous cultures. And by that, I mean Tewa culture, which is the part of the Rio Grande Puebloan culture here, Hopi culture over in northern Arizona, Navajo culture, which extends from New Mexico westward over into Arizona and even tips into southern Utah, and Tohono O'odham culture, formerly known as Papago culture, down in the Sonoran Desert, and then also Hispano culture, which is, I think that after 500 years of presence, that achieves a sense of indigeneity, and also Gringo culture. A good friend, a rancher down near Carrizozo, spoke his essay or his interview, which we put together in a really good way between us to spiff it up for the book, to really try to provide a whole bunch of different perspectives. And then other elements of this book were written or spoken by a young lady who just got her PhD from UNM, and her thesis or her dissertation was the effect of the Glen Canyon Dam on indigenous cultures.
Yeah.
And so she took a chapter from that dissertation and rearranged it as a chapter in this book, and that focuses on the presence of the Central Arizona Project as one of the worst environmental catastrophes of our time, not just for habitat, but for culture as well. And then Gary Paul Mabhan, an old buddy of mine who's an ethnobotanist and a poet and all of those wonderful things, had a beautiful perspective. And my daughter, Celestia Peregrina Leffler, who is the co-editor of this book and also a co-contributor, wrote a splendid chapter about thinking like a food shed.
Yeah.
And then Bill DeBuis is talking about where do we go from here, thinking about his new book, the one that's currently out, called A Great Aridness, and myself. And so those are the folks who are in the book. And boy, it was such a joy to work with all of these different people. By the way, I should mention that three of the other people besides myself will be at the book signing in Santa Fe.
Oh, good.
Rena Swensel from the Santa Clara Pueblo, who is beloved by all who know her. Esteban Arellano from Embudo, who really knows his stuff about Hispano water law. And Celestia Peregrina is coming down from Durango.
So we're talking to Jack Leffler about the new book, Thinking Like a Watershed. And something that you said a moment ago kind of jumped out at me, which is how important it is to think of all these different elements as being in motion. And our language doesn't necessarily lend itself to that, because we tend to think of things, as nouns, as static objects. But to think of our whole entire environment as being in a state of continual change, which is true, is not so easy to do.
No, it isn't. And it's one of the things we are trained to do in our whole educational system is think in a linear way, which is not wrong, but if it's totally exclusive, it's not great.
What do you mean by linear?
Well, in other words, following a good metaphor for that is looking at the Rio Grande, but not look at all the tributaries at the same time. In order to see it with clarity, you have to see the tributarial system that goes into the mainstream. And that's what I'm saying by thinking like a watershed. And it also, I think, addresses what you just ask me here. It takes our educational system trains us in a very wonderful mode to be able to think in a very strongly intellectual fashion, but sometimes to the exclusion of causing other intuitive processes to atrophy at the same time. And
right.
One of the things that I love about every traditional or every indigenous culture that I've ever visited, focusing on the traditional members of those cultures is their expansive perspective. They see a whole bunch of things in a state of simultaneity, and therefore are able to extrapolate future possibilities, maybe not quite as snappily as we do in the laboratories around the United States, but they certainly have been able to solve an awful lot of problems with regard to surviving successfully in this arid habitat, and that's important.
One of the things that comes up in the essays of some of the indigenous people who are in your book, Thinking Like a Watershed, is the concept of sacred waters. And I was thinking, what does sacred mean? What does sacred really mean? And then if you kind of follow the line of reasoning, maybe this is linear, but if you follow the line of reasoning of looking at what works. So in science, you test hypotheses to see if they work, to see if they actually stand up to experimental reality. Well, if you think of a stream or a spring coming out of the ground as sacred and you treat it with that kind of care, that actually works. It is something that makes your society function because then you don't pollute it.
Absolutely. You're celebrating the presence of the spring. One of the things that was pointed out very clearly to me by a wonderful author, Paul Horgan, who wrote a great book called The Great River, the Rio Grande in North American History. I interviewed Paul Horgan back in the 1980s. He hasn't been with us now for a long time. But he really did provide a sense of history for the American Southwest. And one of the things that he mentioned was the way Native American people actually perceive habitat itself as sacred. And with the coming of the European came commerce. And the way I sort of interpreted that was also came secularization of habitat.
Yeah.
And so what we've done is with our presence, with the presence of the European descendants, let's put it that way, in the American Southwest, and the presence of commerce, because we've been such an economically dominated culture for so long, whether it be in Europe or here in the United States or Canada or wherever you are, what we've done is we have not only secularized habitat, but we found that a huge part of our economic system on extracting of natural resources. And one way I think of that and have for a long time is turning habitat into money, which I think I've mentioned to you long
right, that's
before.
The Jack Leffler phrase.
But what I perceive, I had a wonderful conversation last year with Silvia Rodriguez, who is a wonderful writer who is now emeritus from UNM. And one of the things that she talks about within the context of Hispano culture and the transplanted pantheon of Santos that came from the Iberian Peninsula and is now part of Hispano culture right here. She talks about the sacred procesiones that still occur around the time of San Isidro, going to visit sacred places. She talks about re-sacralizing habitat, which I think is a fantastic notion. And that's something that is inherent now in Hispano culture as well as Native American culture, the part of it at least that remains traditional and still perceives the sacred nature of the flow of nature.
And part of what I'm asking is, what does sacred even mean in the first place? What does secular mean?
Maybe the best way for me to answer that is to talk about briefly when I was a fire lookout in the Jicarilla Ranger District of the Carson National Forest back in the 1960s, where you're out there, there was no cabin or anything like that. There was no tower. You're just camped up on top of this rock for 100 days and nights a year. And after you've done that, you know intuitively what sacred means when it comes to habitat. You feel something. You feel the flow of nature in a way that has a lot of poetry to it, but it becomes a very spiritual thing in a way. You're lying on your back at night on the still sun-warm sandstone, gazing into a firmament where you can see stars like you wouldn't believe because there's no light of human provenance anywhere around you. And you start to feel something that is probably what people who are very religious associate with religion, except that to me, it's the pure essence of it. There's no anthropomorphism involved in it whatsoever. It's you within the flow of nature, and you see yourself as part of that. And you see yourself as part of a universal continuum that is just absolutely amazing when you stop and really think about the presence of a universe that's 13.5 billion years old, and here you happen to pop into existence long enough to think about it for a bit and become totally awe-stricken before you blink out.
That's right. We're talking to Jack Leffler, and that is, again, getting back to this notion of states of mind. Reading your book, can't help but think a lot about numbers, 7 billion people on the earth. And it may be, I mean, we were all indigenous, right? We all came from some cell that formed who knows how back, what, how many billion years ago?
3.4.
Thank you. Billion years ago. And since then have come to reflect on ourselves and on our environment in a way that is perhaps uniquely human. And yet we have also created a world for ourselves that is so interesting, but that cuts us off from this nature that we're supposed to be contemplating.
Yeah, you know, Robinson Jeffers, in his poem, The Answer, really addressed that. And David Brower, one of the great environmentalists of the 20th century, took one tiny phrase from that wonderful poem to form an organization, the name of which is Not Man Apart. It's a great phrase. It should be Not Men and Women Apart. That's a bigger phrase. But the point is that...
I think people might be a word.
Yeah. Not folks apart. Sounds nice and colloquial there, but at any rate, what is so great about the Native American people whose presence is revealed in this book is they see their sense of the kindred with absolutely everything within the flow of nature. My friend Camilus Lopez, the Tohono O'odham man, who to me is a true lore master for his tribe or his culture, talks about the relationship between a person as we understand a person and a saguaro cactus, which is also a person within that context, and how it's all so deeply interrelated that the notion of hurting a saguaro cactus is causing harm to a fellow being.
Right.
And it's that really kind of gets to the heart of it. And that's expressed in Rena Swenson's essay. Lyle Belenqua from Hopi expresses that. Camila certainly does. Roy Cady does from Navajo. It's just that sense of the kindredness with the rest of nature, with other beings, that's really important.
And what I think is so interesting is that there's a very wide gap in many ways between that kind of thinking and super hard science. But in fact, there's also a real commonality between those things because, I mean, those cactuses have cell walls and mitochondria and chromosomes and stuff exactly like us. And on a fundamental level, we are very closely related to cactuses and bacteria and cats and every other living biological organism.
Absolutely. And that's one of the joys of science. In no way do I denigrate science. I really believe that science is one of the most amazing ways that we perceive the flow of nature. But in its current sense, it's sort of incomplete. One of the things that we've done, and that's one of the things I've tried to bring out in this book, all of us did, was that we need to create a bigger perspective, a sphere of reference rather than a frame of reference, where you can see as many of these composite things happening simultaneously as you're capable of. And science is a massive contributor to this sphere of reference. But it's not the only one, and that's one of the things we're trying to get across. There's a whole huge array of perspective that's available to cultures that have really participated in, if you could say it, a sacred way, where they celebrate in ceremonial form various aspects, various seasons within the flow of nature. And it's that aspect of it that I think is so important at this point. I think that a lot of the scientific community know that. Matter of fact, I had the great joy of having Christmas dinner with Murray Gell-Mann, who, among other things, originated the word quark.
Right.
And his mind certainly goes beyond just the world of quantum physics. It really, he's a fabulous bird watcher. But the point being is that he understands that there are these other ways of perceiving the flow of nature in a big way. A lot of scientists do. But sometimes, especially in this new age of incredible internetedness, we have a tendency to become locked in to the computer, to the office space where we work. We don't get out in it enough to really see it for what it really is. And I think that that's what the indigenous perspective brings to the bigger picture. And what I'm really hoping is this will help create some sense of communication, or at least mutual understanding, between the scientific community and the indigenous community, indigenous mind.
We're talking to Jack Leffler about the book Thinking Like a Watershed, Voices from the West. One of the things that I think was interesting about Rena Swensel's essay was it was so rich with metaphors, and one of them was water as breath.
Ah, Rena has this wonderful phrase, po wa ha. It's a Tewa, it's three words really in Tewa, meaning water, wind, breath. And that's the way she perceives everything as being interconnected, because everything relies on, every living creature relies on water and air to be within, and the fact that it flows through all of us. Rena and her sister, Tessie Naranjo, who are two of the great fellow humans on the planet, were part of this is a larger project, I should mention this. Thinking Like a Watershed is the book part. There's also a 14-program radio series called Watersheds as Commons. And the whole project was actually made possible by two big grants, one from the Christensen Fund in San Francisco, the other from the New Mexico Humanities Council. And the idea was is that it would involve people from different cultural points of view to participate in this project. And Rena and Tessie were part of the project to the extent that we were able to get them recording equipment and even computers to be able to work all of this stuff. And between them, they interviewed people throughout the Puebloan world in New Mexico, getting all sorts of different perspectives. And then me twisting the dials in radio production, but they coming up with all of the content. We put together one of the programs in here, and it's the Tewa perspective, or it's the Puebloan perspective, not just Tewa. It also involved the Carizan perspective and Towa up in Taos. But the point is that many of the different programs were produced, in part at least, by the indigenous people that we worked with on this. And I was able to help train them do what you and I do, which is to interview people and just get out there and start recording, and getting people's points of view, and then going through the transcriptions of all of this stuff to see what's really good, and then fitting it together. And apropos of Rena, it was that archive of interviews that she and her sister Tessie did. They both collaborated jointly on this thing. One couldn't have really done it without the other. They really got into it. It was incredible. But the upshot is that Rena was able to take the information that they had gained from all of those interviews to create her chapter for the book, in conjunction with her own innate wisdom that comes from having been born into Tewa culture. But one of the things that's interesting to me is that both Rena and Tessie have PhDs. And so they're firmly rooted at this point in both worlds and are able to bridge that incredibly important vast area between the different cultures.
I think that's so important because what you're doing with this book is not just collecting this like an archive to be stored away somewhere. You're, I think, trying to give people the opportunity to shift their own minds, to open their own minds, to maybe make your perspective be wider than just, like, for example, right now I'm looking at a computer screen on which we are recording this interview, and that's a foot away or 2 feet away from my head. And that's one perspective, and I spend way too much time in that perspective, which is a computer in front of me. And the perspective of, for example, going outside and watching animals, that makes you slow down. Or spending time, as I know you do, looking at the sky, that makes you slow down. And those things change you. And again, getting back to the number of people on this planet, some critical mass of people on this planet, I think, need to start thinking in new ways or go back to thinking in the old ways in order for us to face the various crises that we are looking at that come from too much focus on, and I don't think there's anything inherently wrong with it, but too much emphasis on the commercial perspective.
That's a huge concept right there. Part of this whole, well, the radio series part harkens back to people like Garrett Hardin, who wrote The Tragedy of the Commons in 1968, which focuses on the overpopulation as he began to understand it. Well, when that essay came out, the human population of the planet was probably between 3 and 4 billion people. I know that in my lifetime, I was born in 1936, but in my lifetime, the human population of this planet has tripled.
Which is crazy.
It's incredible to me. And the current estimates, is, well, at least as of last month, we'd peak between 9 and 10 billion around 2050, and then maybe population would gradually reduce. Well, that's not factoring in the potential catastrophes. And that's a whole panoply unto its own. There are just all sorts of potential catastrophes out there. One of the things that was brought out in the radio series, which I think I alluded to in one of my essays in the book, was looking at Garrett Hardin's notion of the tragedy of the commons, which meant that everybody kept putting more and more cattle and sheep into this common grazing land, and everybody could extrapolate in advance that if you put too many in there, the ecosystem itself will crash and there will be enough grass to grow to feed all these critters. And he likened it to a Greek tragedy because even knowing it in advance, they did it anyway.
Right.
And it crashed. And so he said, Garrett Hardin said, and he became a friend. I really liked him enormously. He was an interesting man. But Garrett Hardin said that there are only two ways to be able to deal with this. One is to bureaucratize the way the land is governed, and the other is to privatize the land. And one may work or one may not work. But
neither of them sounds really all that great.
No, but then I had the great opportunity to interview the great economist, Eleanor Ostrom, who got the Nobel Prize in 2009, I think it was, for her book, Governing the Commons. And so her whole point was, and this was based on game theory that she was using within the context of what she was doing, was that if you factor the idea of mutual cooperation into the mix, it begins to work. And so what she was forwarding, which I think is a really brilliant idea and is really coming to be part of the heart of this whole concept, is that governance for home habitat has to have a strong input from the grassroots. It cannot just be governed from the top down. It has to be governed from within. Thus, one of the things that I'm trying to get across in this book is what I think to be the need for some gradual sense of decentralization of political power. Now, another aspect of this book, and one of the things that I really think is really important to think about, is that much of law and legislation is designed to define and defend the corporate economic will, and then be rendered into legislation through the political bureaucracy, and then be administered that way. And that becomes a dangerous mode, because that means that the primary focus is economics rather than the bigger picture. Well, economics is certainly a big piece of the pie, but it's only one of a whole bunch of pieces of the pie that really have to be addressed. And so that's one of the things that this book tries to create, is that there's a much bigger perspective with regard to the way we have to perceive ourselves relative to the planet, the home bioregion. Our planet is the home bioregion. My friend Melissa Savage talks about that. She's a biogeographer. She and I have worked together for 40 years at this point. It's hard to believe, but at any rate, that's a very important factor in this whole thing. We have to see the whole planet as a living entity. And if we kill it off, adios y buena suerte, we're gone as well.
Right. You say early on in one of your essays that it is possible that we as a species can respond to the potential or real crises around us as a superorganism, like the human species as an organism. What does that mean? What does that look like?
Well, to me, in the ideal sense, it means that here we are within our home bioregions, our home watersheds, our homelands, our home habitats, and we become really well acquainted with how the natural history of our home habitat functions within itself. And then we see this patch that we live in as part of a much larger mosaic of habitats that includes the entire planet, as well as the oceans, as well as the atmosphere itself. In other words, the biosphere is the whole planet. And by understanding how to comport ourselves successfully within the context of our own given habitat, and we're in a much better position right here where we live than, say, in Manhattan, for example, because we have a chance to actually observe the flow of nature in motion and not just be blocked into concrete canyons. If we can actually become involved enough and get our young people involved enough from an early enough age to see that we are indeed, what is our role within this home habitat. And then we expand our purview to include other patches of habitat, in other words, our adjacent watersheds. In other words, we live near the top of the Rio Grande, but we have to be just as careful in behalf of the people at the other end, over 1,800 miles away. We really do. That's what I'm saying. If we use the flow of nature to interrelate, and this does not exclude science by any stretch of the imagination, because there are fundamental principles that apply throughout every watershed. If we begin to think in those terms rather than just focusing on economics, then we indeed can become what Edward O. Wilson says to be the mind of the planet. And that's what I'm talking about.
We're talking to Jack Leffler about his book, Thinking Like a Watershed, Voices from the West. I think it's tricky. I mean, everything you're saying sounds great. And then you look at the days that we live, the way we spend our time. And the reality is you got to pay your rent or your mortgage at the first of every month. You got to pay your bills or there's no water. Speaking of water, you've got to do all these things for many or most of us that involves drawing a paycheck. And that structure of our economic life is the basis of the way we live. Most of us are not growing our own food or really relying on the weather that much one way or the other. In fact, we complain when the city doesn't plow our streets properly and things like that. And so making that leap and keeping the things that we actually like about our our modern life, it's tricky business.
It sure is, and I certainly don't have all of the answers, or even maybe any of the answers to this, except that I hearken back to some of the people that I've read in the course of my life. I look at people like Henry David Thoreau and Aldo Leopold and Peter Kropotkin. Peter Kropotkin is one of my favorite thinkers, and I've mentioned this on earlier of your wonderful programs. Peter Kropotkin, born into the Russian nobility in the mid-19th century, early on decided he didn't want to be part of the gentry, but rather he wanted to study science, and became a world-class geographer. And after he had become one, he moved to Siberia in order to map mountain ranges for 5 years. But he was armed with Darwin. And based on that book learning, so to speak, he started really observing wildlife, different patterns. And he finally concluded, and this appears in the final pages of his magnum opus entitled Mutual Aid, that evolution of species, parenthetically, culture, owes far more to mutual cooperation than mutual antagonism. And that, to me, is a huge thought. Now, another huge thought that comes out of Aldo Leopold, and I will get to what you're asking here momentarily. In the final essay in a Sand County Almanac, the final essay is entitled The Land Ethic. What Aldo Leopold talks about is looking at our relationship to land, not just through economic terms, but through a sense of aesthetics and a big sense of conscience. And if what we're doing is not good for the biotic community, then we have to stop doing it. Okay, well, that's a fundamental, those become fundamental principles to me. Thoreau also factored conscience into his perception of humanity's relationship to homeland, as does Gary Snyder. Gary Snyder is one of the greatest bioregional thinkers we have on the planet at this point. But what I'm trying to get to here is that we cannot exclude economics. We can't even think about excluding economics. But we have to modify our relationship to homeland, and economics plays a part of that modification process so that we can perceive beyond just the economics. In other words, we have to live lifestyles that may not be quite as luxurious as we have grown to into. And boy, I'm no great shakes at that. I drive a car, and I use electricity for my computer and all of those different things. But to try to ease up on the use of it and try to, I think the biggest key is to really spend enough time out of doors in it to be able to re-relate to the flow of nature, to really understand that.
I think that equality plays a role in this. So if you have the kind of near feudalism that we are moving towards, it's very hard to do what you're saying.
Well, actually, we're not just moving toward it. We're ensconced in an enormous sense of a medieval-like feudal system right now. And this starts to get into the touchy areas as to just how do we relate to things like this. 37 years ago, my late best buddy wrote a novel called The Monkey Wrench Gang. Edward Abbey, good guy, truly one of the great people I've ever known. We had a lot of good times together, but the point is that he responded. One of the conversations that Ed and I had over the years was, is one born an anarchist or does one become an anarchist? And I think that Ed was born an anarchist. I knew his dad, who used to recite Walt Whitman to Ed Abbey. And one of the great phrases that his father, Paul Revere Abbey, would recite to Ed was, "Resist much, obey little." Walt Whitman.
And so his father made him an anarchist.
Well, his father came that way, too.
Yeah.
In a way, I think it was genetic. But the upshot is that Ed wrote that book, which is a wonderful book, which may well soon become a movie, in the early 70s. And he was using as a model what was happening out on Black Mesa, the Black Mesa Mine, the Black Mesa Railroad, all of those different areas that contributed to the debacle of the environmental rape of that whole region, and not just environmental with regard to the flow of nature, but also with regard to the human species within that, because we can't separate species from the flow of nature, which is one of the things I think we have to really try to understand. But at this point, when you look at the so-called 1% or 0.01% or 0.001%, one of the things that I'm really trying to get across is that getting into violent action is dangerous business, considering how armed and dangerous that 1% can be. One of the things that I think about a lot, and this goes back to corporate-dominated politics, which we're looking at big time right now in October of 2012, and the next election is going to tell a lot of tales in a lot of different ways, not the least of which is that we have a two-party system that celebrate the same economic mode and are both incapable, it would seem, of perceiving beyond that. And that's something that really needs to be addressed, but in a different radio program, maybe.
Well, and one of them, even if it could perceive beyond that, it can't win an election without being part of it. That's the
absolutely
big problem.
And so we have to increase our political perspective big time. And this has to be understood within the corporate realm. Corporations are not all bad. They have contributed an enormous amount. But their primary purpose is to make money for the shareholders and their cadre of personnel.
So how do all of us bring this other sense of consciousness, which is not inherently anti-corporate nor pro-corporate, but basically the wider perspective in which we are all living beings crawling around on this earth, and we really need to pay attention to each other, both for our own happiness and for our own survival. How do we get that bug into the ear of the people who make decisions to where they start making better decisions?
Well, we're fortunate here in New Mexico that we have a couple of good thinking people who have solid environment at heart going into the political process. I'm speaking of Tom Udall and, if we're lucky, Martin Heinrich, both of whom have spent a great deal of time out in it, so to speak. When I first met Tom Udall, well, he had yet to go to Prescott College, which is when he became involved in Outward Bound, which is a pretty vigorous program. And that's what he was doing as a late teenager, early adult, was participating in that, which helped shape his perspective. His father's perspective was also shaped by life on a ranch near St. John's, Arizona. Now, I've met Martin a few times, but I don't know his background. But I do know that he does spend a fair amount of time in it and has been very much involved with the New Mexico Wilderness Alliance. Both he and my daughter used to work there together years ago when she was at UNM. Trying to get people to understand this is easier west of the 100th meridian, but before you get to the west coast, than it is east of the 100th meridian.
Where's the 100th meridian?
It runs right down smack through the north, South Dakota, Nebraska, Kansas.
Okay.
Oklahoma.
So it's easier to get people to understand things in the American West.
Because it is dry and there are fewer of us, and you can see yourself relative to homeland a lot easier. That's a biggie. By the way, one of the things that really strikes me, and another person who's really influenced this, both the book and radio series, was the early 19th century explorer John Wesley Powell, who grew up back east, and at one point, just like Huckleberry Finn, built a raft and started floating down the Mississippi River because he was fascinated by the wildlife. Another scientific hero, and Edward O. Wilson, spent a lot of his childhood out observing wildlife. Just watching helps enormously. You begin to feel the sense of the kindred, but you can only feel a sense of the kindred if you get out in it enough,
right,
to be able to experience that. If one locks oneself up, one loses sense of one's cousin, the tree.
Yeah, or the prairie dog.
Exactly.
One of the things that I think is a reality of human life, and I've talked to anthropologists about this and archaeologists, whether it be ancient civilizations or people on Earth now, is that we tend toward boom-bust cycles, and we tend to wait for crises before we respond. And I think before we really respond to things. And I think one of the challenges that we're living right now is that if we really wait for the global warming tipping points all to tip over, we're really screwed. Like, we have to kind of do this in advance, and we don't seem to be wired for that kind of thinking.
No, and we haven't been traditionally. I just read an article in a recent New Scientist magazine, which I highly recommend, written by a fellow named Mike Marshall. And he pointed out that a whole slew of earlier civilizations, starting with Akkadians back over 4,000 years ago, extending right through Mayan civilization, Chaco Canyon civilization, just a whole bunch of civilizations foundered either coincidentally or by some other form of design at times of incredible climate instability. And the bottom line is when the water goes, so do we. There's just no way around that one. And so that's only one of the factors, though, that happens in a moment of climate instability. But it's certainly one that's immediate. And here we live in one of the most arid regions, well, certainly in North America. And we are really approaching a time when it could be up to 30% less water coming down the Rio Grande or the Colorado River. To me, the Colorado River watershed, the greater watershed, and the Rio Grande watershed are sort of like two butterfly wings separated by the continental divide. It's really a neat thought. I love that thought because it really represents an organic entity,
right,
that's interrelated. And somehow, here we are in New Mexico, where 80% of our water is actually pretty much dedicated to agricultural purposes, which back at the beginning of the 20th century was regarded as best use of water. But now the agricultural people and the urban people are inevitably going to be at loggerheads over who gets the water. That's one of the programs I tried to include in my Watersheds is Common programs. And I talked to a wonderful thinker by the name of M. Hall down in Albuquerque. He's a writer as well as a water lawyer. And he pointed out that because of our having grown to rely on interbasin transfers of water, like the San Juan Chama Diversion, which basically takes 110,000 acre feet a year out of the Colorado River watershed, actually the Navajo River, which is a tributary of the San Juan, and ships it 23 miles beneath the Continental Divide to land in the Chama River at Heron Lake. We've grown to rely on that 110,000 acre feet, but because the Colorado River watershed is in a lot worse shape than we are here, that puts us in direct competition with Los Angeles, San Diego, Phoenix, Tucson, Las Vegas, all of whom rely on the water from the Colorado River. And so, as according to M, who's going to win in that kind of a struggle?
Jack Loeffler, when you're doing work like this, you can't help but at least sometimes have some kind of doom and gloom perspective on the world in which we're living. Because when you see the worst case scenario, which is laid out right in front of all of us if we open our eyes to it, that's scary and depressing. What do you think is our best path?
Well, I think the one really good one, and this is based on both Celestia Loeffler's essay and Gary Paul Nabhan's interview, talks about the importance of evolving the food shed concept within our watershed, which I think is fantastic. And we're so blessed to be in this particular watershed because we have the most incredible level of diversity one could possibly imagine here. One of the things that's
been... What kind of diversity?
Cultural diversity, biodiversity, geophysical diversity. One of the things that was brought out to me fairly recently is that New Mexico is third highest in diversity in the United States. California and Texas are more highly diverse by virtue of being on ocean coasts. But New Mexico, with its altitude range from around 4,000 feet all the way up to over 13,000 feet.
And mountains and deserts and forests. And
yes, it's incredible. And there is water here to nurture us, even though we may be right at the top of the list for less surface water, relatively speaking, than any other state. But right here in the northern Rio Grande watershed, which I think of as being from, that includes the San Luis Valley of southern Colorado, extending down to what my dear friend Esteban Arellano says goes down to La Bajada, that hill. That's this whole bioregion here, and it has different regions within it. But when you think about the way people have survived here successfully over the years, and what you see as the kind of foodstuffs that can be grown here over the years, and the way people can comport themselves successfully over a millennium, that says a lot. And so what I'm trying to say here is that if we look at the cultural diversity that includes the Native American perspective and its different Native American perspectives throughout this region, it's not just the Puebloan people. It also includes Apachean people and Navajo people. And then you have the Hispano perspective, and these are people who have successfully lived here now for close to 500 years. There was a moment of truth back in 1680. But these people have adopted systems that work really well. And then we have our now Anglo system here, which includes, in large measure, a lot of the people in the Los Alamos National Laboratory. We have the possibility to meld perspective here like nowhere else that I know of, period. We could become a model of how you make it if we really go for it.
Jack Leffler is a bioregional oral historian, radio producer, writer, sound collage artist, and former musician. His new book is called Thinking Like a Watershed, Voices from the West. He has co-edited it with his daughter, Celestia Leffler, and as you've heard, many voices in that book. And once again, on Friday the 19th of October, he will be reading at Collected Works Bookstore. And Sunday at 3 in the afternoon, October 21st, he'll be in Albuquerque at Bookworks. Thank you so much for joining us again on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you so much, Mary Charlotte, for having me.
And you can find out much more about Jack Leffler's work and download his audio programs and all kinds of things at loreoftheland.org.